these are obviously a very broad picture. And obviously I'm really thinking of the retrospective position, trying to look at the implications of what was decided at Makerere or of council postings in the curriculum development or in English medium schemes and so on, and trying to evaluate in the longer term what's happened in countries which are of use to Namibia. I don't know whether you want to talk about the current scene anywhere, or whether you would want to evaluate what has happened in Tanzania specifically, or...
I don't think I'm familiar enough with the current scene in a number of places to be able to say very much about it, and the only African country I've been to very recently is Tanzania, where I didn't see a great deal of the English teaching. But of course I was in Zimbabwe 4 or 5 years ago.
Where things are encouraging in many ways, I sense.
Perhaps, yes. I mean, it seems to me that probably there's been a bigger explosion of primary education than could actually be catered for, but in the speed with which it was developed. But certainly the infrastructure was much better founded in Zimbabwe than in any other African country at the point of independence, if only because it had been kept became independent so much later.
One of the things that's happening in the Namibian scene is some of the Zimbabwe people who are working on natural sciences. Do you know the Zim Science Project? They're also attached to our Namibian planning team. And there seems to be an interest in integrating the language work in the natural sciences and social sciences into the English as a medium or English as a subject.
And which is what the Zambian English Medium Scheme in primary education did in the late 60s. As systematically as it could.
Did it really ever try that?
They had a scheme that was entirely, as I understood it, to try and integrate subject teaching with the development of English at primary level.
I'm surprised to hear you say that. I mean, the only references I've seen to that kind of thing have been Ralph Isaacs' work in
learning
through
language. Yes, but that, of course, was only a 6-week intensive course.
It was.
I think the so-called English medium scheme in Zambia, which Bryson McAdam wrote up in a doctorate at Manchester in the early 70s, was deliberately trying to do that. I think it was 1973.
I've seen references to that. Of course, I've also seen a lot of criticism of it.
I think there are lots of things that are unsatisfactory about it. But I think that was the intention there. And similarly, I think Singapore also had a scheme for integrating early English teaching with subject-based work.
But I mean, that raises the more general question, which comes down lower under research, as to whether there ever was any very serious attempt to do hard research on the relationship between L1 development and L2 medium learning.
I have some problems conceptualising what form such research could actually take that would show you anything. I mean, I do have difficulty with most... views that you can assess educational policies or teaching methods policies and find a way of measuring what happens in any one case against what happens in any other case. And I think the variables are so difficult to control that it's very unlikely one will arrive at anything that is. And I think probably the only way you can systematically and self-consciously evaluate educational innovation is by trying it and monitoring it and putting yourself in a position where you're never too far gone to withdraw if necessary.
Yes. But I don't know whether anyone has done that kind of monitoring very systematically, because one of the problems in the council is that people have moved over to new posts every 4 or 5 years.
Yep. I think one of the biggest weaknesses in the work of bodies like the council is the 2-year contract syndrome. A project that are going to be successful in more than 2 years will be turned into projects that have to work in 2 years simply so somebody can get them onto their CV or so that they can be completed while somebody's there. And I did have direct experience of this in Tanzania when I was specifically asked how long it would take to develop a really effective English teaching program within the context of a Swahili medium education. And I said if you were dealing with a 6-year program, you needed to allow 8 years for development. Just in about the time that I was leaving.
I think that's exactly what the North American experience in bilingual education shows as well.
Yes, indeed.
It requires that kind of a time scale to do it.
Yeah, but what happened in fact is that the person who took over from me said they could do it in 2 years, a whole lot.
It was more welcome,
No, they weren't more welcome. And in fact, they did do it in 2 years and then had a whole lot rejected The package wasn't in fact implemented at all. Yeah.
But one of the practical implications of that is that, for instance, the Zambian scheme was assessed in that doctorate you mentioned by somebody who was totally committed to it, right?
Of course, it's by the bloke who devised it, and exactly the person who should not have assessed
it. Exactly,
That's right, yes.
But I mean, at the same time as there obviously would be difficulties in evaluating any of this type of involvement, some of what I call tenets here, under number five, have been major policy guidelines.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And with hindsight, I think that the training of people who did, let's say, their MAs in linguistics EMT in the 60s pushed us over in that direction in rather a dogmatic way, even if we were liberal arts graduates who weren't quite so hooked onto specific models of learning as, say, the American.
I don't think this is a problem that is exclusive to ELT, nor is it a problem exclusive to overseas countries. I think it's a result of the need to simplify when teaching. Where you get in-service education, you get people who simplify, and when they simplify, they produce something which in the end boils down to a series of rather dogmatic statements.
I think
it's certainly true that the in-service courses that I was exposed to when I was a teacher were very strong audiolingual and very dogmatic courses, partly because of the personalities of some of the individuals, some of whom are now still in the council, but mainly, I think, because of the nature of the situation, that teacher trainers tend to be rather over-dogmatic when they're doing short courses. It breeds that.
Yeah.
I don't, however, think on the whole that tenets were disseminated totally uncritically. And certainly not the ones you mentioned. I mean, I've been at more seminars where the notion of English as a medium was debated very hotly by expatriate advisors than I've been at ones where there was any agreement. The oral approach, possibly. Monolingualism, I've not heard debated at all. And in fact, possibly because I was mainly in Tanzania, I can't recall any time when anybody advocated monolingualism as a principle.
It depends what I mean by it, actually, there. And I think what I'm thinking of is that you don't really use the mother tongues, or even Swahili, let's say, as a resource in order to improve their English learning. That you explain vocabulary in the target language as well, that the
direct method assumptions,
yes.
Well, of course, that's partly because of the theoretical concept of interference and the notion that you were operating two systems that had to be kept distinct. It wasn't, I think, necessarily for any reason more sinister than a psycholinguistic reason. A wrong one, I think, but I mean one that was nonetheless very widely held, and it would have been found just as much in Europe as in Africa.
Yeah, except in foreign language teaching traditions, where...
But even there, the foreign language theorists were saying all the foreign language teachers were wrong, and they were only mixing languages because they couldn't do it properly, it wasn't held to be a desirable thing to mix languages, I think, in the 60s.
True, but I mean... I think that the translation grammar tradition was rejected more or less for the wrong reasons at that stage.
I think that's true. Yes.
The monolingualism
tradition may well go back to something Bernard said this morning, that the problem with people like Gattonby and Hornby and West was that they were abysmal at learning foreign languages.
Well, of course, might also be in their strength as well, that language teachers deal more often with people who are abysmal at learning languages than people who are good at learning languages.
Yes, of course,
I mean, I don't know where Gattonby, Hornby and West were. They may have been, I have no idea.
It's not anything I've heard before in any sense. But on the other hand, I think that the fact that the majority, I don't know, you may be able to say that more than I can, but I get the impression that the Celts that I've met, say in the field in Zambia, working either with Namibians or with Zambians, don't regard it as a priority for them to know any of the mother tongues of their learners.
I was told by a Tanzanian local education officer that if British teachers learnt Swahili, it would mean they weren't spending enough time doing the teaching they were employed to do. They were employed to come here, teach and go away. They were not employed to come here, integrate and mix. Now, of course, you got a spectrum of people teaching across all subjects, right from total integrators to total withdrawers. But I certainly wasn't seen as either that you shouldn't learn Swahili by whites, nor that you must learn Swahili by blacks. I think it was divided across a whole range of factors that wouldn't really fit neatly into either a nationalist or some other kind of paradigm.
But if one wants to look at it from a principle, language learning theoretical perspective, one could argue that anybody who's going to be recruited to teach Namibian should at least be familiar with the structure of one Bantu language. And that doesn't seem to me the kind of thing that has ever been seriously debated as a requirement for...
The Makerere course I was on, there was an optional but taken by most people course in Swahili, and an optional but taken by most people who intended to go to Uganda course in Luganda.
Oh, really?
Mm. Uh-huh. The view, as far as I recall, of the English language panel in Tanzania was that people should learn Swahili, but the intention, of course, was so that they should understand the notion of interference. It was not that they should exploit it as a learning device.
No.
On the other hand, several of us at different times, I can recall, played around with whether we were capable of conducting a whole class in something through the medium of Swahili in a sort of competitive sense. Yeah. So I don't think there was an unwillingness to touch the language. What wasn't there was it was any real concern for languages lower down the system than Swahili, and indigenous local languages were only, I think, pursued by academics rather than by people who were straight teachers.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I go back to some of the issues about support? It was my general impression that in the 60s that British ELT policy was filtered through agencies like the Council and the expatriates in the Ministry of Education, primarily because the last place you would expect to get Africanization would be English language teaching, simply because you would tend to go for native speakers.
Yeah. The ideal teacher.
That certainly, I arrived in Tanzania in June 64, and I don't think I encountered any expatriates in education who were not arguing the view that the sooner they handed over to nationals, the better.
The better, yeah.
The big problem, I think, and I think it's a problem in a lot of African countries, has been that people with high administrative capacities or high academic capacities have always got better jobs to do than teaching, and they move very rapidly through teaching and out of teaching simply because it's the lower level of middle range administrative skills and so on that are where you need very large numbers of people. And when you had a structure as you had at Independence with a very small number of highly trained people, they tended to move very rapidly through the system into the top positions, and you kind of Africanized from the top downwards rather than from the middle upwards.
Yeah.
That having been said, you have of course then got a constant to-ing and fro-ing, and one of Tanzania's policies was to recruit English teachers who very often were not native English speakers but were Europeans. So you got volunteers from Denmark, from some of the Eastern European countries, even in one case I think from the Soviet Union, teaching English.
Yeah. Was that a problem in fact? I mean, it was necessarily...
Not that I observed anyway, because the ones who taught English were graduates and they were normally from countries in which the level of English graduates was very high, and sometimes it was an advantage because they were actually language learners, unlike many who, like myself, went out primarily with literature degrees and another tongue.
I can well imagine that would be an advantage. That's precisely the area that I'm working in now with the Namibian project, where the teachers will be Norwegians.
Yeah, right.
And where their own awareness of English needs to be adequate, whether they're teachers of English or of scientific subjects or whatever else.
The only really big problem I encountered in teachers of other subjects in Tanzania was when the first batch of Japanese physics teachers arrived with virtually no English, and there was a tremendous... I mean, they were put into schools and rapidly withdrawn from schools and arrived for a language lab intensive course in English.
Yes, I can imagine.
some issues perhaps on training and research that I'd quite like to pick up. It seems to me that a lot of your questions are about adequacy of British activity. And it does seem to me to be fairly clear that British activity has been a great deal more successful in terms of what was needed by African countries than American has been. And of course, there's been a massively greater commitment by Britain than there has in any other country except the States to training in this sort of direction. Now, the extent to which the training actually provides what was needed is very difficult to assess. Particularly as any kind of training that is claiming to send you out to almost any possible country at almost any possible level for almost any possible job in language teaching is bound to be rather general.
Absolutely,
and it seemed to me that the really skilled practitioners one found, the skills were largely attributable to personal characteristics or to long and close acquaintance with a particular area. Topped up or supplemented or eked out with some kind of training of a more general sort. The people who went and applied their training, quote, were nearly always disasters. Somebody who produced a notional syllabus in a very crude form in Zimbabwe, directly arising out of a not fully digested notional syllabus from an Edinburgh MSc dissertation. Something which I found in the cupboard in most primary schools that I visited, untouched by pedagogic hand.
No, obviously lying behind that was my own experience of the council's own internal training program in Madrid, which was so pragmatic that I don't have a single page of notes from it, actually. Roger Bowers was on the same program, actually. And then I went on to the Leeds MA 3 or 4 years later, which was then... it was Terry Mitchell's stepping stone to a chair of linguistics.
Which year were you on that?
69. In other words, the language teaching element in my day was handled enthusiastically by some young people who were very open, but professionally of very limited value, actually.
One thing that I think you'll probably agree with, but it has seemed to me for a long time that the training and development of language teaching experts has been very insensitive to economic, social and political implications of what happens, and that is a dimension that it seems to me is very rarely raised. There is actually a recent book which addresses it from a Canadian perspective by Mary Ashworth that is the first book I've actually seen that specifically looks at language teachers and says let's consider the questions that are associated with political and social activities.
Do you have a fuller reference?
It's called Beyond Methodology, published Cambridge University Press this year, I think, maybe last year.
That's interesting.
By Mary Ashworth. But that's one area that it seemed to me that we constantly neglected. The other big lack, I think, is that language teaching was seen to a very, very heavy extent as something which was a technical matter that could be isolated from the rest of education. It goes back to something else we were referring to earlier. And often it would ignore general educational research, and because so much money goes into EFL, you've got too heavy a bias from EFL in a strict private sector type into the general language teaching public sector world.
When you talk to Peter Strevens, as I did yesterday, he's immensely confident about the EFL world at the moment. He seems to think that in terms of classroom effectiveness, the EFL world is... years, if not decades ahead of anything else, either ESL or foreign language teaching anywhere in the world. And I wonder how far this is a reflection of the private language school effectiveness, or whether it's even all that valid in any case. I can well imagine this is a feeling which keeps a dynamic language school
It may be the case that a small number of high-level institutions have achieved such high motivation for their staff that they are able to generate enormous success with students. I don't know. My impression of the staff at the Bell Schools is that they are very good, very committed, very well supported.
Yeah.
but it also is the elite of the elite. So, you know, there are carpets everywhere.
Yeah.
When the British Council 2 or 3 years back did a series of video recordings for teacher training purposes of the best teachers in a number of direct teaching operations around the world, it seemed to me the level of teaching was appalling. That there was an RSA stereotype lesson that took place whether you were in North Africa or in Mexico or in the Middle East or the Far East. It didn't make any difference. You got the same lesson, which this was very worrying. And the only two lessons I saw on that, which I was an advisor on this project, the only two lessons that I saw that were really high quality were both from Mexico, one by a traditionally trained audiolingual non-native speaking Mexican teacher, the only non-native speaker who was filmed at all, who produced something that was heavily audiolingual, but she knew exactly what she was doing and it was very effective in its own terms. And the other from the only teacher we saw who hadn't been RSA trained but had been trained actually at the London Institute of Education and was a general, you know, had a you know, an EFL with a general educational bias, and she produced something which was much more humanistic and imaginative and divergent than any of the others. So I'm not so optimistic, I think, about the general EFL scene. It may be very good for highly motivated small groups of middle class adults. I'm not at all sure that it's having a good spin-off on EFL teaching as it typically is in normal state schools.
And I think that much of what one reads about the ESL situation is utterly depressing, just because the ideas seem to have been semi-digested, and teaching is an underprivileged profession.
I think that to some extent that's true. Also, there's a lot of very good work going on in ESL in this country. It's patchy and it's bootstraps because there hasn't been a strong commitment by government to getting a high level of professionalism and a career structure for people working in this sphere. They can only rise above grade 1 or 2 by moving up.
The publication is a useful thing in that sense, the latest DLT document.
That's right. Whether it's useful or not, it's certainly the only thing that covers that area.
It was what wasn't available 3 years ago when I was looking into that in London.
It was intended to address itself to that sort of thing.
But what you've now described is the business of the council being a key agent in the field. Masses of people posted all over the place with council as the middleman, at least, if not the employer. And then the academic world on the other side.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether the council has been deciding policy or whether the academic world has been influential at all in that area.
My reading of policy from a council point of view has been that on the whole the council casts around for what they think the local people want and then articulates it actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's been a kind of sinister plot. I think there's been far more pragmatic responses. What the council's wanted is to be in the centre of English teaching wherever it is. I think generally speaking, the council has reckoned that, and this is my observation of practice rather than hearing any principle. I shouldn't think it would ever be adumbrating quite as such a principle, but I think in practice, English language officers, CELT officers, and council representatives wanted to be in the centre of whatever English teaching operation was, and they therefore played the game of trying to interpret what will be the centre and then getting there, rather than saying that it matters very much what it is you do, so that you get widely divergent policies in different countries, always providing, of course, that English continues to be maintained more or less. But there have been council officers who've argued very strongly against the promotion. Rafe Isaacs is one, against the promotion of English at particular levels, and I think he was very influential in getting English out of primary schools into secondary schools only in Ghana.
In Ghana, I can well imagine that. And certainly there are people like Peter Constable in Zambia whose rep can't really understand why she's writing about cognitive development in another tongue as opposed to English.
I think that's... and of course one has to remember that the council is a large bureaucracy with its own impetus, and I think its biggest in some ways least satisfactory impact on the world at large in policy terms has been the push for ESP of a highly administratively convenient nature, where there's been on the whole bureaucratically successful promotion of procedures that seem to fit in neatly what administrators want, rather than what language learning is going most successfully to achieve.
I've not really followed that. I've not been in touch with anything of that kind. Is that a general development all over the place?
I mean, that happened in the 70s, and it's now had offshoots in a lot of places. What I mean is, I mean, things like needs analyses, which actually look like quite strong scientific apparatuses that can enable you to determine your curriculum responding to the needs of the people by going through a certain lot of machinery, like John Lumbee's. Has become something of a policy document, or did. It's now been reacted against, but it did become something of a policy document which meant large numbers of countries were using, I think, inappropriately sophisticated technology using not so much a sledgehammer to crack a nut as using some kind of a complex set of machinery to crack a nut.
This is something I read into Roger Bowers's postscript to the English in the World conference report, where he implies that we are pushing for various developments because they are characteristic of our society, or because they reflect the state of knowledge in a particular academic area, and where the risk presumably is that we are preventing the third world countries from solving their own problems by in some way occupying the available space in education and frustrating local development. Is that your own?
Well, I think it's possible. I think it's also very difficult in specific examples to with absolute confidence say that that is what is happening. I mean, it seems to me, for example, you can't say to a country, don't buy foreign advisors if you want to. If you have foreign advisors, it seems to be the only way for the advisor to operate is to say, I will give you my view of what it is you ought to do, as strongly argued as I can, taking into account all the circumstances that I can, and you will make the decision over whether or not I'm doing the right thing and whether or not I know enough about it to be able to say the right thing.
Sure.
But it seems to me it is your business as a foreign advisor to say what you think ought to happen, regardless of the implications.
And I think that's exactly the way Torv and I see our role in the Namibian exercise, because we are trying to benefit from the experience of other countries, to learn from that. We're also trying not to be neo-colonialist in what we recommend. But I mean, there's a serious problem of assuming that the local people in question are in fact able to make the right decisions. And in a way, this is the political issue in a nutshell. I've just reread the report on the Anglo-American conference in 1961, which was the third in the series, but where I.A. Richards says categorically in an afterword that in his opinion English should be pushed internationally, and that if any other countries for nationalist reasons there was resistance to this, then we had to explain to them that they were mistaken and didn't appreciate that the whole world lay with English. And it's exactly the same now in the present context, that we may well be in some way either tending to press things because we can see from our own perch that they are relevant. Or alternatively, we may have people we're collaborating with who are obviously members of some kind of elite in wherever that may be in the third world, who are themselves the products of a colonized consciousness, and in some way...
I think there are very big and major theoretical questions that are difficult to resolve, and I think that really does raise my major worry about the paper you and Tony presented at and Hugh at ILA. It seems to me it's necessary to have a model for cultural change which is not necessarily sinister. And I'm puzzled as to how you can have a model for either education or communication which doesn't involve changes in balances of power as a direct result of the processes of education and communication. It seems to me that it is not satisfactory to say either that particular languages are irrevocably identified with particular ideologies. I think it's probably true that, that socialist propaganda, there is more socialist propaganda in English than in any other language. It is probably, as it is undoubtedly true, that there is more capitalist propaganda in English than any other language. I don't think either of those actually means that English cannot be used for or against either of those positions, or indeed any other position. I do think it's important for from another tack that we should have a strong commitment to multilingualism. I've argued in print myself that it should not be a commitment to the promotion of English. I mean, I think the British Council should be in the business of promoting, in many ways, promoting French, Russian, Arabic, Chinese as well.
Yeah.
But it does seem to me that every person in the world should have access to one of the major world languages. Otherwise they get exploited. I think there is a real question of who exploits who. And the notion that that one wants to have a mother tongue access all the time seems to me, in practice, only to push the problem lower and lower down the system, because there will always be those who can't economically afford to provide with any language who will be left out.
Yes, and this is exactly what has happened with, say, the situation in Mali. You know Kelsey's book, do you, on linguistics and colonialism?
No.
It's, do you read French, do you?
Yeah.
It's called Linguistique et Colonialisme.
Yeah.
He's also written more recently about the same sort of thing, and where there was a big UNESCO project in Mali to develop four local languages. And what's happened is that one of them has in fact been really effectively established, a bit like Swahili Bamba. And there's cultural imperialism from that language vis-a-vis the other three, effectively now.
It seems to me that's unavoidable, actually. I mean, which language it is may be avoidable, but having languages that are dominating and languages that are not dominating seems to me to be something one just has to live with. And I must say, I don't like the kind of educational decision that one has to make over, for example, Welsh. You constantly have the problem. Is there, should an administrator make a decision? Should the parents have the choice? And what happens if the parents make the wrong choice? Should the children have the choice? Is bilingualism actually taking time off learning other things and making you less competitive with other people who are monolingual? Not saying that these are easy questions to answer. It seems to me that there isn't a straightforward answer that says yes, all minority languages ought to be promoted regardless. At the same time, there is similarly there's no clear question that it should operate the other. I mean, I'm not trying to oppose the general movement in the last 15 years towards a much greater recognition of linguistic diversity. Yeah. It doesn't seem to be simple.
And
economically, it's very problematic.
The whole of the second half of our paper, in fact, is a very quick canter through a whole range of variables.
Most of which, when broken down closely, I think would raise certain sorts of problems.
Would raise more issues than it clarifies, actually. Although I think that the need to have some kind of tabulation of factors.
I think is very valuable. I mean, not of course attacking large portions of the paper seem to be extremely useful. But I am worried about the lack of the. Essentially, a model that sees colonial languages as intrinsically and unavoidably not creating more communicative capacities, so that you can argue back with, you know, you can expropriate your expropriators if you like, which you can't do if you have no access to that language. On the one hand, or as a medium, for example, of communication across Africa. I mean, you tend to talk about, African languages as if they are, you know, just lots and lots of African languages all equal status, because they aren't. They also are competing, fighting, and rising up and down in economic competition.
I have two quick reactions to that. The first is that, according to the CBOM report, which you may have seen, there are instructions from the board of the British Council to the DG that the mandate of the British Council is to promote the languages of Britain. It's not just English,
that's true.
Actually.
Yes, it is true.
And I doubt whether this has ever been done very systematically, but it seems to me that that
is a bit of our literature. Celtic literature literatures are actually explicitly referred to in some of the literature, for
but
example.
But I think that is the kind of opening that one could, in fact, press for both the indigenous minority languages and the immigrant
and resources to be that actually is something that has been raised at a meeting in the council in the past year.
Interesting.
I think there is some interest in promoting. Ewan Reid is concerned that there will be some move in this direction.
Yeah, good. I tried to drop the hint to Randolph Quirk actually as well. It seems to me that if he's on the top board, a sensitivity to the power relationships in that particular area could well be very constructive.
Yeah.
The second point was really where one goes in following up the need to clarify the power relationships in those languages and all these issues of language planning. You said multilingualism, for instance, and I don't know how one can guarantee that, say, the whole Celt body is committed to multilingualism. I mean, they don't necessarily have that from inclination or training.
No, although on the whole, people who go abroad to teach English are more committed to multilingualism than people who teach English in Britain, I think.
Yes.
I mean, in general, the fact of going abroad tends to make people more in that direction.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a risk, in a sense, that people who are actually on the in the area of conflict go there because they are sensitive to the fact that it's an area of conflict, and then, of course, get all the kicks.
Yeah.
It's rather like ESL teachers for a long time are the ones who were accused of racism, but in fact, at the beginning, they were the only ones who were actually explicitly addressing issues of racism by the means that seemed most obvious to sort out. So, I mean, you can get heavily attacked simply for going to the firing line, whereas people who attack you may stay further from the firing line because they didn't actually see it as the firing line early enough.
I think one of the reasons for Goldman me making a link, making such a crude link between imperialism and English, is that in the Scandinavian context, English is the imperialist language.
Yes.
I mean, it's invading the language, invading
but what I don't see is how it's avoidable. I mean, what I want is a model of change that is non-imperialist. I think, the difficulty.
Yeah, I quite agree.
It seems to me that one can mitigate. I mean, it seems to me, as indeed I would take to be a position that one can reasonably adopt over 19th century imperialism. One ought to find ways of mitigating it. One can't find ways of not having it, because it's impossible to conceive of, as far as I can see, massive technological imbalance without having some imperialist type model.
Which
seems to me, on the whole, to be a classical Marxist position,
I don't find that there are many people who've written about this very interesting. I mean, Masary, for instance, has written very extensively about this, but I don't find
it repetitively.
And not particularly revealing.
To some extent, I suppose Paulo Freire has touched on it on occasions on the side of various issues in Brazil.
Yes.
But
not
again,
from the point of view of educational language planning within an educational system.
No. No, I mean, no. I think it's a difficult issue, and the book I referred to by Mary Ashworth, it does actually raise some of these questions, but is simplistic and often naively liberal, I think, in the kinds of answers it offers.
Yes.
On the other hand, it does clearly expect teachers to address such questions.
Yes. Yeah, and that's
But it's much more at the level of should we or should we not expect teachers to go and teach in different places where the language may be used as part of a dictatorship. It's more that than
And that's the kind of thing that the council ought to be asking in terms of where it's supposed to be.
I mean, there are questions I think that are sometimes raised. And my own feeling, as I said a little bit in the paper I gave at the council 50th anniversary
Yeah, sure.
Seminar.
my own feeling is that issues of language and identity do become very crucial, and the question one wants to ask is a question like, supposing somebody in Namibia wants to learn English, or supposing there is a policy decision to learn English, what is it that you are making a bid to join? I mean, what is the constituency of Namibian speakers of English?
Yeah.
Who do they want to talk to? What do they want to represent? It seems to me quite clear that lots of speakers of English in China do not represent in any sense an assimilation view or an imperialist view or a whole lot of other countries, but they still wanted to teach to speak English. They still wanted to be able to translate when I was there, mainly the Peking Review into English, and they still wanted to be able to use it, but very much as an instrument of attack on a series of values that would traditionally be conceived of as English, but that's why they wanted English.
Yes.
And I think there are a wide range of options available, which have to be considered as part of the development of any language planning policy.
Sure. I shall have to try to elaborate some of them.
Right. Probably, I don't know whether we ought to. It's 22, isn't it? Yeah. Are there other things that you especially wanted to?
No, I think it's more a question of whether there were any other bells that were triggered off and which you felt an urge to react to.
It seems to me that a lot of people in agency British Council and in teacher education and in educational administration would like there to be a series of training strategies and a series of theoretical principles derived from abstract disciplines like psychology or linguistics or whatever, which you can go out and apply. It seems to me quite clearly that all these things only make sense because they have implications, not because they have applications for what one does. That if one is going to have an international toing and froing of various kinds of expertise, these are going to have to depend on the quality of the people and their ability. Which presumably must be proven from past experience elsewhere, the ability of such people to have taught, to have developed materials, to have done things in various countries, responsive to a situation, but not in some sense applying a rigid model or framework that they've derived from elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I think it more damage is done by the notion that we will eventually find a framework that we can apply than by the notion that there are theoretical ideas and abstract principles floating around. These need to be discussed, but nobody should imagine that you can go away from that discussion and put them into application somewhere. It isn't, I think, the relationship between theory and practice.
Yeah. Are you confident that the main applied linguistics departments in Britain are in fact pursuing that kind of a line these days?
No. To some extent, I've had long arguments with Henry Widdowson, and I think we probably are in many ways in agreement on the implications of this.
Yeah.
But it's an issue that it seems to me far more worrying in continental Europe and in the States, where one sees, as for example in the Pitt Corder volume on interlanguage, where there's much more of a view, I think, that you can find descriptive language models and simply apply them.
A
comment that was made by one of the European colleagues at that seminar was, it's simply a matter of finding the best order in which people should be taught things, and there are no other pedagogic issues when you've discovered that. Any belief that you can transfer from science to practice in that sort of way is extremely dangerous, I think, because it breeds the sort of fanaticism you were referring to at the very beginning. Certainty is a very worrying and a view that social sensitivity is not important. I mean, I think, for example, a lot of your citations of the Canadian evidence would now, a few years later, we'd be a little bit more hesitant about the success of the Canadian bilingual experiment. And I think we'd be a little hesitant about particular views about the status, the relationship between English and French. Clearly, it is very dependent on political attitudes. It is much more evidence that English learners have learned French successfully than there is that French learners have learned English successfully from immersion programs, I think I'm right to say.
Yes. True. But I mean, the French group have as a whole been not interested in
Yeah, but the question is why,
immersion. Yes.
I mean where they there's also strong social pressures and your identity, I think, is in a way your identity as English can afford, I think, because of the dominance of English, to be liberal and open. Your identity is almost anything else, any of it, including the other major world languages, is a bit on the defensive because of the accident of the dominance of English. But it seems to me that's something that English experts have got to take into account and recognise. And consequently, there may well be many countries where people should in fact be learning any language other than English as their major world language, in order that there are alternative.
Yes, right. I mean, that's a very good argument in Scandinavia at the moment, actually.
Right. Yes.
That it would be easy to get an immersion program for English anywhere in Scandinavia, but that's the last thing that ought to happen.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. You'll have to make sure you get a seat, though. Otherwise,
join the queue.
Yeah.